The Baltimore County School Board have decided to expel Dexter from the entire public school system.
Oh, Mr. Kirk, I'm as upset as you to learn Dexter's 2 and 3. But surely expulsion is not the answer.
I'm afraid expulsion is the only answer. It is the opinion of the entire staff that Dexter is criminally insane.
Welcome to the Ian Anderson Security Podcast. I'm your host, Pion.
And I'm Dick Turnip.
On today's podcast, we'll be discussing the latest news from the hacking community. Hacking with Android mobile security applications. We'll be discussing SQL injection in some detail. And we'll also be discussing Dick Turnip's progress with the flawed SQL injection testbed that I coded. And we'll finalize with some security issues when attempting to defend against SQL injection. So, Dick, how are you doing? It's our third podcast. We seem to be on a roll now.
Yeah, I'm good. It's another late one, but it's nice and quiet, so we'll be able to have a good bit of crack, a good bit of banter.
Absolutely, yeah. And we've been getting good feedback on the podcast as well. It's still obviously a work in progress. We're learning as we go along, but I quite like the progress that we've done so far.
Yeah, we've got our sound recording issues. We're getting there with those, and hopefully we'll start getting some guests on soon and getting a bit more content.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a guest lined up for next week, and I'll discuss that at the end of the podcast. So we're going from strength to strength. So in the latest news, just following up, we've been talking about the compromise of the kernel.org and linux.com servers over the last two podcasts. Now, linux.com released a statement recently just on the actual attack on the server. So I just want to read this out just so people are aware of what the current status is. It says, our team is working around the clock to restore these important services. We're working with authorities and exercising both extreme caution and diligence. Services will be coming back online in the coming days. They also add at the end that, as with any intrusion, as a matter of caution, you should consider the passwords and secure shell keys that you've used on these sites to be compromised. If you've reused these passwords on other sites, please change them immediately. So what they're saying basically here is that they can't confirm that these were compromised, but just as a matter of precaution to make sure that you change your passwords, as they may be compromised.
Well, straight away they've done better than Sony, haven't they? I mean, you got to take your hat off to them there.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm quite perplexed by this, because like I said in the last show, to be able to attack something like Linux.com or the kernel.org servers requires a great knowledge in exploiting, attacking systems, compromising systems. This is not a first choice target for someone. If you're trying to gain bragging rights, you're not really going to look for the linux.com server, because you know it's going to be secured. So I can only assume, and this is obviously a guess, that it's a zero-day exploit floating around that the admins are not familiar with. And I'm sure we'll hear more about that in the coming weeks as to the impact it's had, and whether or not kernel.org, the repositories have been compromised or altered in any way. Also, today is officially the 10-year anniversary of the NIMDA worm.
Yeah, it's 10 years already. It's flew by. The NIMDA worm changed names quite a few times, didn't it? Went through a different amalgamation of versions. Was it Code Red? It was the Code Red worm, and it was changed to something else that some kid got jailed for like 18 months.
Yeah, Code Red was it came out the same year. I think it came out in July of 2001, 2 or 3 months prior to the release of NIMDA worm. But the differences between obviously Code Red and NIMDA was that Code Red had a single attack vector, I believe, while the NIMDA worm had multiple attack vectors, which included email, network shares. There was Microsoft IIS, directory traversal flaw, which is their old web server. And also it exploited some backdoors that had been left by one of the variants of the Code Red virus. So it was attacking multiple vectors. Which meant that at the time, it became the most widespread virus on the internet after only 22 minutes of launch. So that tells you how rapidly this took over the internet and the impact it had, not only on the internet as a whole, but on businesses. It obviously, many systems were compromised and there was a lot of damage done and losses incurred because of the virus.
And 10 years on, they still haven't got the writer of the Nimda worm?
Yeah, it is. Now, as far as, from what I can remember from the footprint of the worm, it is believed to originate in China. And if that is the case, then it's a lost cause trying to locate who actually wrote the virus. I don't, like a lot of viruses, it's very hard to track it down just because of the nature of how they spread. It's very hard to track down the original source. And then obviously this is one of the cases where they didn't catch the author of the worm, and he got away scot-free. Well, he probably caused millions, if not more, in damage to company losses.
It's quite interesting how over the last 10 years, I can't speak when I'm on a podcast for some reason. It's quite interesting over the last 10 years how much that malicious sort of programs have changed. You know how in the early days it was worms, like polymorphic worms, and they were specifically to target Microsoft Windows, but not in the way that malware is created today. So, you know, there's a lot of money making and organized crime that are sort of that manifest a lot of the malware, and it's to, you know, to scam money for fraud. But back in the day, well, not even back in the day, 10 years ago, it was more about infection and disruption.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously some of the worms that were written had also political motives back in the day. I think just because of how operating systems have advanced and the security measures that have been implemented, that worms obviously have to be more unique, more individual, and sneakier to actually get them to affect and impact on a wide-scale basis. We also have operating systems, Windows, coming with default software, like the Microsoft, I think it's Defender, which is the anti-malware application. I believe, I'm not 1,000% certain, but I believe that's now default with all Microsoft operating systems. So that will obviously assist in defending against these systems. But then you have to also remember there's still a lot of people who are still on old operating systems. For example, Windows XP is still widely used and it's very vulnerable. If you don't have, even if you do have the latest Windows XP patches, it's still vulnerable. But if you, anyone, and there's probably still millions of systems out there who have a default install of Windows XP, whether it be a pirated copy that doesn't allow them to install updates or just the fact that they don't have automatic updates on and they're lazy. These are systems that you can compromise literally in a matter of seconds. So there is still these systems out there and they still help propagate these old worms. You'll still see old worms that might have been out of the spotlight for 6 or 7 years, and all of a sudden you look up at the virus lists and you see them cropping back up again. So you know, it's still a problem.
I think as well the nature of worms is it's going to go, it has done, and it's going to go more industrial, like corporate espionage, industrial espionage, rather than attacking the personal user. You've got the Stuxnet worm, which affected the was it the Siemens microcontrollers for the nuclear power plant?
The Iranian nuclear reactors. Yeah, that's correct. And that was a very extensive attack on the Iranian nuclear infrastructure. And then there was obviously discussion as to whether there was collusion between the US and Israel to end or at least halt the Iranian nuclear program.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me either. But that, I mean, that's the extent as to where viruses are going now. Attacks, it was discussed years ago about how nations would be compromised and affected through, the medium of the internet rather than through wars, through bullets. And this is really the first large-scale case where this happens to be the case, where the Iranian nuclear program has been hit, has been targeted, and not one single bullet was fired. So there's obviously very large implications there.
It's cyber warfare, baby.
Cyber warfare. It's here, and it's only a matter of time before Skynet get on the road.
We're all gonna die.
Wag the, sure. So yeah, that covers our news section for the moment. Now, I've done a little bit of development with Android, and I'm really impressed with the Android platform, and to a wider extent, how far mobile development has come. If you compare the old Nokia phones from 10 years ago, where you had Snake, to the phones that we have today. Now I've got a HTC Hero, which is obviously, it's not a top of the range Android phone, but nevertheless it's got Android and it allows me to write applications for it. But my first computer had far less processing power than this phone. This phone has a 500 megahertz processor, which is, I can't even remember. I think my first system had a 40 or 50 megahertz processor. So it's 10 times more powerful than my first computer. So that goes to show how far we've come. And obviously the newer phones, the newer Android phones are 1 gig and 1.5 gigahertz. So we're really getting up there. They're nearly getting up there with laptops.
We're getting multiple core machines, and it's not just the mobile market now as well. They've got all the tablets that are coming out, and I think tablets are going to be around for quite a while.
Absolutely, and I think there's security implications as well with mobile developments, because now if you root your Android device, you've got root access, you've got shell access, you can write your own exploits and whatnot. So you're now in the position to attack systems on a network in a very incognito way. Like a lot of people, obviously you can sit in an area with public Wi-Fi access with your laptop, but to do it with your phone, that's a lot more incognito.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot more discreet. I mean, people's going to think, oh, it's probably just, answering a few Twitter messages. Send a couple of SMSs, but really you could be sitting there and you could be sniffing traffic, intercepting people's credentials.
So looking at Android and the potential for regards to security applications, there's two I want to discuss in particular. One is DroidSheep, which is it's a mobile implementation of FireSheep. Are you familiar with FireSheep, Dick?
I haven't used it. I know it's out there. I know it exists. Man in the middle attack. Do you think we should explain to the listeners what a man-in-the-middle attack is for anyone who's new out there?
Yeah, sure. So with regards to FireSheep, how it works is it implements a man-in-the-middle attack through session hijacking. And what happens is if you're on a public Wi-Fi network, it masquerades as whatever user is logged into whatever web application. So for example, with FireSheep, if you're on a public network and someone is logged into Facebook, you can masquerade as them by using their session to Facebook, so you will actually be logged in with their application. So what DroidSheep is it's a mobile implementation of FireSheep, which allows you to do the same thing, except instead of using your laptop and a web browser, you've actually got a mobile application for the Android platform, which allows you to perform a session hijacking or a man-in-the-middle attack. And at a simple level, I just want to explain how at a simple level a man-in-the-middle attack could work. You would generally use address resolution protocol to trick your gateway and the target machine into believing that you are the gateway and the target machine by spoofing the hardware address of each system. So you would also, if you wanted to perform the actual man-in-the-middle attack opposed to a denial-of-service attack, you would forward traffic from the target system to the router. So everything that is submitted from the target system that you want to attack would actually have to go directly through you. And doing this, you can use applications to pick up the traffic like SSL strip, which would allow you to log the credentials of someone logging into, you know, an application like Amazon, eBay, PayPal, etc. So there's obviously huge security implications there. But now what we have with DroidCheap is the fact that you can go mobile, you can go very discreet, and you can connect to a public wireless network and masquerade as any user on that network.
And if you're sitting on a public network, the common user on a public network isn't going to be thinking about the guy who's sitting next to them that could be sitting there with his mobile phone and basically intercepting all their traffic that's going in and out. Now, it's a nice covert way to do this, because you're not sitting there with a big screen where people can see, you know, if someone walks past and shoulder surfs you, and they can see that you've got some weird program up, and, you know, there's TCIP written in a column, and might think, oh, what they're doing there. With your phone, you can basically just stick it under the desk. You can hold it down. You can have a look. I mean, people aren't going to see your phone anyway, so you could just blatantly sit there and just look at your phone, and as you're capturing the data live.
Exactly. So we've come a long way from the days of Snake on the Nokia phones to where we're actually implementing session hijacking on a mobile phone, or a cell phone, as the Americans call it. And to me, that's something that we're going to have to address with regards to the protocols that are used on networks. And I think we need to totally revamp and rethink the way the internet is designed. We're going to have to eventually migrate over to Internet Protocol version 6. And we're going to have to look at IP security implementations and other various methods to ensure that any traffic sent is secure, and that the host and gateway are actually legitimate systems. Now, for me, if I'm on a public network, the way I can do that is to monitor my my ARP table. You can set static addresses on Windows or on Linux for your ARP table. So let's say you've got your router, it's set up, you know what the router's MAC address is. You set that as a static entry into your ARP table. And that means that anyone who's trying to implement a man-in-the-middle attack through address resolution protocol would not be able to do so, because they can't trick your system into believing that that they are your gateway. So that's one way of defending against it. There's multiple ways to defend against it, but just at a simple level, that's how that would work.
Yeah, I do think it's good that that people are weaponizing mobile applications, mobile hardware, because it's going to force vendors to take a deeper look into security, and it's going to bring more sort of advances in the mobile market.
Sure, absolutely. And just on top of the actual topic of man-in-the-middle attacks, I did write a short paper on how to implement man-in-the-middle attack on Linux, and how to log credentials using SSL strip. So what we'll do is we'll upload that to the website, and you can give that a read through. It's not long, very easy to use. And after 5-10 minutes, you should be able to implement a man-in-the-middle attack. So just moving along, there's a new tool that was released recently by an Israeli hacker, I believe, called Zook. Not sure how it's quite pronounced. It's called the Android Network Toolkit, or ANTI for short. Have you heard of this one, Dick?
I've seen it mentioned. I haven't looked into it in any great depth. I was actually talking to the head developer of Node Zero Linux, and we were talking about building our own suite of security tools for Android. I'm a Java coder, so we were thinking that we would have a go at weaponizing the tablet market, but obviously this guy's beat us to it.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason why you can't code an exploit for Java to make it run and attack a target system, like an individual exploit. But I think what most people have been looking for is something like a Metasploit implementation for Android devices, which would really expand the usefulness of the platform as, you know, a pen testing system. Now, what the Android Network Toolkit does is it tries to bring this all together. So it's got multiple features, including scanning, operating system detection. It performs a trace route, a port scan. It checks default router passwords. It monitors the network traffic from a Wi-Fi perspective. It also acts as a web server, obviously implications there for tricking systems. It implements a man in the middle attack, and also it allows you to remotely exploit target systems. So I'm not sure how in depth the database is for the exploits. I'm not sure how many exploits come with it, but I'm assuming that it has most of the commonly used exploits today. So in a sense, it's kind of like a mobile implementation of Metasploit.
Yeah, it looks like a good bit of kit. Like I said, I haven't done too much research into it. One thing that'll be interesting will be to see the model of how, if you create your own custom exploit, how you would get your exploit onto the Android network toolkit itself.
Yeah, well, it does state that it has plugins which allow you to extend the toolkit itself. Now, I'm not sure, does it allow you to add your own custom exploits, write your own custom exploits and import them into the system, or is it just a plugin system, a general plugin system? I'm not quite sure. I haven't had a chance to use it yet, and it's still in beta. So from what I've seen, the free version, he may be charging to use the likes of remote exploits, which personally I feel is wrong. I believe that anyone who's writing applications that are used to test security, they should make them free. They should be open source. That's just my view on it. But the common features such as scanning, OS detection and so forth are available in the free beta version. So if you just Google Android Network Toolkit, it should be available. It may also be available on the Android market. I haven't checked yet. I'm assuming that, like Dried Sheep, it requires that your Android device has been rooted, which means you've root access, full access to the system at every level. So look, this goes to show how far we've come with mobile devices and how they're going to be used as a platform to attack systems. So just moving along, last week we discussed web platforms that allow you to attack web applications from a legal standpoint, to learn the common security methodologies such as SQL injection and so forth. So what I wanted to discuss tonight is just perhaps a simple attack that one might use through SQL injection. So I explained last week how SQL injection works, how it's really just tricking the string and entering in your adding to the query to make it do or pull information or implement whatever you want the actual string to do. And how that would work is perhaps if you had a website called target.com, it had an index.php page and it had a get variable called ID. What you would do, let's say it was ID equals to 10, just for example, which would pull up the article number 10, you would append onto that your query if it was vulnerable to SQL injection. How you would test that is by adding an apostrophe to the end of the, in this case, an integer, a 10. And if it was not sanitizing input or checking for SQL injection, it would give you back an error. With MySQL, it would just let you know that there's an error in your SQL syntax. And that's how you know at least it would be vulnerable. So following along for that, once you've determined that it actually has that it's not sanitizing input, what I would generally do, because there's such a large scope for SQL injection, there's no one correct way for doing this, but this will work for just the majority of straightforward SQL injection attacks. What I would do after determining that there is a flaw in the script is just to determine what columns exist, the number of columns that exist for output data, and then what columns are visible to the user. Now, it may not be the case that they're always visible, and there may be some sort of a blind SQL injection involved, but I won't touch on that. I think I touched on that last week. But just from a simple perspective, what you would do is you had your target.com server, index.php, ID equals to 10, you might do something like order by 10 or order by 20, we'll say. and then you close it off by ending by your comment, by ending the comments, right? So what would happen is your query has got a certain amount of columns that it's pulling from to output data. Okay, so let's say, for example, if you're selecting from a user database, you might be selecting the username, the password, the email, and maybe their real name, which would be four columns that exist in it, and maybe ID. So let's say five columns. So if you did order by 10, 10 columns would not exist. So what it would do is print back an error to you, which says unknown column, 10 in the order clause. So you know for a fact that there's not 10 columns. Now you might not know, you might not have access to the code or how the application looks, so you won't know how many columns exist. So what you would do is you would decrement, go down to, with the order by clause, you would decrement to 9, to 8, to 7, to 6, until it showed the information on your screen that wasn't an unknown column error. So let's say you went down to 6, it gave you unknown column 6 in order clause, you went down to 5, order by 5, and you saw the normal web page loaded, you'd know that there was 5 columns. So, are we following so far, Dick?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you've got 5 columns, and then what you want to do is use a union select statement, which would join the output of the original query, which is what the web application is asking. Maybe it's asking for the article name or the user or the author or whatever. And you're joining that with your query. So how that would look is you had target.com slash index.php ID is equal to 10. Now, normally what I would do to make sure that you don't actually pull any information from the original query, you could either use just add a minus to the digit or just use null, which would pull no information. I prefer to use null just for my own personal reasons. So you did ID is equal to null. And then a space, and you've got union select, and then we know there's 5 columns because we've done the order by clause. So you do union select 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then you close it off with two minus symbols, which would act as a comment and close off the rest of the statement. So when you execute that, you'll have a look in the page. And what you're looking for is any one of those digits to appear on the page, because that would mean that that column is visible to the screen. Now, it may be the case that they're all visible, it may be the case that none are visible, or maybe the case that only a few are visible. So let's take, for example, you've implemented the attack, you've got the web page, and you see the number 2 and the number 3 in the screen. So you know that the application is asking for data that exists in the second and third column, and these are the columns that you would actually use to view data or to execute a function, etc. So now that we know column 2 and 3 are empty, are visible, we can use these to perform a function. So one function you might perform is version, and that would be just either at version, depending on the SQL server. It might be, for example, MySQL. You can either use at version or version and then the two brackets, like a standard function. And that, what that would do is print the actual SQL Server version to the screen. And that's very important for determining how you want to orchestrate the attack. If it was MySQL version 4, you know you don't have access to the information schema table, which I'll get to in a moment. If it's MySQL version 5, you do have access generally to the information schema table, which makes the attack a lot more simple. So are we okay so far, Dick?
Yep.
Okay, so we've got your 5 columns. You know column 2 and column 3 are visible, and this is where you're going to be outputting your data. So we're going to imagine that we've got MySQL version 5, which is a result from the version function. And what I'll do is I'll add some sample attacks, some attack strings on the website, just so you can see how this works in principle. So you've got your two, visible functions, or your two visible columns, and we're going to use the information schema database to pull the table names and the column names. And all the information schema database is it gives you information of all the databases, including table names, column names, the users and their privileges, such as file access, which is very useful for attacking or implementing a web shell on the server and so forth. Mm-hmm. So Let's say, for example, we use column 3 to output our data. You'd have union select 1, comma 2, and then in the third column, you would have, you could use just table underscore name, or what you can use is use the group concat function, which will concat all of them in one. So you're not individually trying to pull table by table by table by table. You're going to group them all into one so you can view all the tables. So you'd have union select 1, comma 2, comma group underscore concat, and in the two brackets you would place table underscore name. Then you'd have comma 4 and comma 5, which obviously you still got to specify those table, those columns. And then you'd have your space, and like any other query, you have to specify what you're actually pulling it from. Where are you pulling this information from? And for the table names, it would be from information underscore schema dot tables, and then you'd end it off with a comment. Now what that would do is would pull back all the table names in the database, but if you wanted to specify just the table names in the actual web application that you're attacking, you can use the table schema clause. So you could do from information schema dot tables where, so you're using the where clause, where table schema would be table underscore schema is equal to database. And that's database in the brackets, and you're obviously closing off with your comments. And what that would do, it would only list the table names in the actual database that the web application is using. So let's say on the screen now, where the third column was, we now see two tables, let's say users and articles. So we don't want to attack articles. This is probably meaningless information. What we might want to do is attack users. So we following so far, Dick?
Yep, I'm still with you.
Still with me. Okay, so we've got the users table. So now we don't know what columns are in the users table. Now we could guess that it's got a column called users and a column called table, or a column called password, but we don't know. So you could guess, or you could just once again query the information schema database and this time look at the columns. So what you would do is you'd use your union select table. And on the third column or the second column, whichever you prefer, just in this instance of an attack, you use your group concat function again. And this time, instead of table name, you would use the column name. That's what you would be calling. So you do column name, and then obviously comma 4, comma 5, from information schema dot columns, this time instead of tables. Mm-hmm. And you would do, now you need to specify the table name that you're actually pulling the columns from. So you would do where table name is equal to, in this case, users. So that would list all of the columns in the users table. And once again, I'll give examples of this in code, in actual code on the website, so you can follow. I know it's going to be a little bit difficult to follow this visually without viewing the code. So if you listen to the podcast and look at the code examples, this will make a lot more sense. So we pull all the columns from the users table, and we might see username. We might see ID, username, password, and email. We're not really interested in the emails, not really interested in the ID, but what we are interested in is the username and password section. So all we have to do now is we go union select 1, 2, and then in the third one, we can use the concat function. So we'd use concat, and in the concat brackets, we would specify user, a comma, and password. And then another comma, you've got column 4 and column 5. And now we know that there's a users table that exists, and that's where we're pulling this data from. We just specify from users, and end it with the comments. And what you would do is we'll get the username and passwords for the database. Now, usually in web applications, most of the passwords are hashed with MD5. Which, if the password is weak, you should be able to rip through it in a matter of seconds. So is there any questions so far there, Dick?
No, I've been using that technique today, actually.
Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. So what I want to do is, on the website, once again, I will demonstrate these attacks with actual code so you can visually follow this. So you've got your username and password. You've tricked the system into forming your own query. You've mapped out the database. You know what tables exist, what columns exist, and you know how to pull data from the table. Now, there's a lot more advanced techniques involved in sequel injection, which I'll follow up with at a later podcast. But that gives you a general idea of how you might attack a web application and pull the username and password from it. So, Dick, we've been looking at... we've been discussing a web application I created called Flawed. It's still a work in process. And it's a testbed for people who want to learn SQL injection and also WAF evasion, which is web application filtering. Web application firewall. So you've been playing around with this. How have you found it so far?
Yeah, it's been good. It's been good. I started off at the beginning. I installed it. Pretty easy to install. You just get the SQL file, paste it into PHP MyAdmin, the SQL box that lets you run live queries on the database, sets everything up for you. Went to localhost on my Apache web server, got into the application, started off on level one, got in no problem. I haven't done any web SQL injection for months and months and months, so it took a bit of time to get back into the swing of things, the methodology and going through the logical steps and remembering the syntax. But once I'd remembered and, you know, got my brain in gear, then I've got Bill Gates's credit card details.
Excellent. So obviously the idea of the web application itself is just to pull information on a number of well-known individuals in the IT world's operating system developers like Linus Torvalds, Bill Gates, and so forth. And then I've added a column called Credit Card. It's just for fun. It's just, you know, to add to the thrill. And the idea is obviously at each level you've got to defeat the filtering to get the credit card number for whichever individual. Now, on the first level, there's no filtering implemented. So how did you find the first level?
It was pretty straightforward. It's, you know, the method that you've just spoke about there. I'll give the users a clue to start off on the first level. If you go through those logical steps, then you'll be able to pull the database data that you need. And, I'll just reiterate what you just said about the credit card details. They're not real credit card details, just in case we've got any government officials listening who don't know their ass from their elbow.
sure. It's just made up credit card numbers. They're not actually real credit card numbers. It's just for the thrill of the game itself. So obviously there's four levels I've added to the Flawed web application. And as you progress up the levels, there's more filtering added. So obviously on the first level, there's no filtering implemented. You get to level 2, level 3, and level 4. That's more filtering. And what it is just to allow people to practice SQL injection from a legal standpoint, but also learn about defeating web application firewalls, which are commonly implemented on systems today, on web applications today. Now, 2 to 3 years ago, you would rarely ever see a web application firewall, but today they're very commonly implemented, and a lot of people, it's no longer sufficient to just know SQL injection. You've got to know how to defeat web application firewalls as well. And from a pen testing standpoint, a lot of the common automated SQL injection tools are a bit iffy at defeating web application firewalls. So it's good to actually understand how to defeat them, because if you are going to be paid at a professional level to attack a web application, you need to be very thorough. Obviously, you can give a scan with an automated scanner first, but then go through it manually and try to defeat the web application firewall itself. Be very thorough about it, because if you miss something, chances are someone with more with less than noble intentions will cause problems. So it's very important to do that.
I mean, even simple things when it comes to testing, there's the simple methods you can use, like case switching.
Sure. What some web application firewalls will do is they will look for key strings like union select, but they will look for union select in a single case, let's say lowercase. So what you can do is you can mix up the case. You can do union select in uppercase or mixed case, And that it can trick some common web application firewalls out there. And that's a very simple example of how one might defeat a web application firewall. But it just goes to show that the methods that most web application firewalls use are they're not very good, and they shouldn't be used to secure a web application. They shouldn't be used as the sole security measure to defend a web application. So I just want to discuss a little bit about, I suppose, the common problems when trying to secure against SQL injection and some of the poor methods used by developers. The first thing is that you quite often see people using blacklists to say, you can't use this, you can't use this, you can't use this. But it makes a whole lot more sense to specify what you can use. And the analogy that I use for this is that if you look at, let's say you've got a bar, a club or something, you've got a doorman on there. The easiest way for a doorman to filter people is to say, only over 21's allowed. He's using a whitelist. He's saying, only these people are blacklisted. He's not saying, if you're under 21, you're not allowed. If you're wearing trainers, you're not allowed. He's just using a very simple approach. This is my whitelist. This is what I'm allowing into the club. But I'm not blacklisting anything. So I think that's the best way to go about it. Now, some people use the prepared statements, and other people use filtering to create a whitelist. So what I would say is that if you are trying to defend against SQL injection, while there are some very good blacklists out there that people have implemented, one of them is on the web app. I'll have to get I'll post the URL, but it's a web application blog on WordPress. I will post the address on the website, and it covers some very, very good filters. But even at that, it's not enough to rely on these filters in a blacklist format, because once again, they can be defeated. So I also want to discuss about, I suppose, the dependency that web admins use on web application firewalls. A lot of them overly depend on these. Now, they're good as a backup precaution, but what you should always do is make sure that you focus on secure coding rather than relying on a firewall. If you use the two together, secure coding and a web application firewall, you're going to be a lot more secure. But what's happening, at least from my experience from pen testing, is that web admins are becoming lazy with their code and depending on web application firewalls to secure their web application. They're saying, okay, look, I know there's something wrong here with this, but I'll fix it up in a couple of weeks because the web application firewall will keep me secure until then. That is bad. You should not do this because the web application firewall is not foolproof. So I always say the first protocol should be to make sure you write secure code. Now, the problem with languages like PHP is that there's a lot of people out there who are taking up PHP because it's so easy to learn. It's so easy to develop a web application with because of how easy it is to learn. So there's a lot of people with no experience in programming developing websites. I know a lot of people. I know one company, one local company here, was developing dynamic websites. And from a visual standpoint, they look very pretty. But from a security standpoint, they were very easy to break down and to get information from. So this is what happens when people with limited security experience develop web applications and they don't secure them. So I think that if someone is going to develop a web application for you and you're seeking out a company who does develop web applications, you should definitely inquire about what sort of security precautions they take to defend against cross-site scripting, web, other web attacks like SQL injection and so forth, because it's very important that they are familiar with these terms and are familiar with the functional methods of how to secure against them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that with this, the point about secure coding is it's something that developers just aren't taught when they're learning the fundamentals. You get a lot of people who, I'm one of them myself. I've just recently completed an HND in software development, and I'm going on to university as a mature student for the final year to do a BSc. And basically, when you write code and you're being taught the fundamentals, and you're learning the basics. At no point whatsoever does security and writing secure code come into the equation. Now, for developers in a professional environment, I think a lot of the time is money for developers. They've got schedules to meet, deadlines, they need to have this made. There's loads of jobs that go on to put the final package together. And security is a necessary evil for a lot of developers. They know that it needs to be done, but they might not have the time or the knowledge of security subjects to implement them in the code. And I think that if people really want to start building more secure applications for their companies, and then they need to start getting developers to be security minded, and they need to set up an education program where people aren't just learning to write code and learn an object oriented methodologies, which is the big methodology that gets taught in education these days. The people need to be coding secure methods, functions from the start, and they need to know why they're doing it as well. Until then, it's going to be the mess that we've got now, and it's all about education, and I just don't think that there's enough security education going on around the country and maybe even around the world.
Sure, absolutely. And what I would say is, anybody who's interested in learning web application security, I definitely take a visit to the OWASP webpage and sign up with your local chapter. And it's obviously subscribed to the mailing list. OWASP is the leading group with regards to pushing for more security within the web application world. And there's a lot of ongoing projects with OWASP to learn web application security. So definitely give that a visit.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like we were talking about the education thing, even a lot of books that you get these days, they'll touch on security. They'll tell you to put strip tags in web application security, tell you to put strip tags in, and maybe it's MySQL, Real Escape String. But there's not a lot of books that actually cover things like session hijacking and how to implement security measures against that. There is a good PHP book out. I think it might be an O'Reilly book, Essential PHP Security. I downloaded that a while ago on my Kindle, and I've picked up some really good tips for web application security in PHP. There's some nice little functions and methods in there that do help.
Sure, absolutely. So that pretty much rounds off this podcast, the third podcast. Now we're going to have another podcast next week, but for next week's podcast, we're going to actually have a guest with us, Dick, which is Beeve from the 2600 community. Now, anybody who's not familiar with Beeve, he's one of the head admins of the Vistech Debt Row cluster, which is an open VMS cluster, which allows anyone from the public, if they want to learn about the open VMS operating system, to sign up for a free account there and learn about Open VMS, which is very useful, and it's allowing more people access to an operating system which is has been otherwise very obscure and not talked about. He's also involved in the Telefreak project, which is a public PBX for people to learn about that technology, and allows people to have public conferences and so forth. He's also familiar with the with X25. He's given discussions and talks on X25 hacking, converting using voice over IP to connect a modem to such a network. And I'm looking forward to having him on the show. He's a very interesting character with a wealth of experience.
Yeah, I spoke to Beef quite a while back now on 2600. He's a really nice, approachable guy, and I'm looking forward to having a conversation with him, and hopefully as time goes on we'll get more guests, and you know, we'll have a good natter on with people. If there's anyone out there who's interested in coming on the show, and you feel like you've got something that's relevant to talk about, then you're more than welcome to get in touch with us. All the details are on the inetizen.org website on the contact page. Just send us a Twitter message or an email, and you know, we'll work out getting you onto the show and having a bit of a crack.
Yeah, absolutely. We're always looking for guests, and anyone who has something to offer, just get in contact with us and we'll have you on the show. So until next week, that's it for me, and it's Dick Turner.
That boy needs therapy.